You're listening to Feedback with Bill Saunders on News Talk 830 WEEU and 830WEEU.com. A new generation of talk.
News you can use.
I feel more informed when I listen.
News Talk 830 WEEU.
You were working as a waitress in a cocktail.
Oh, my, my, my. What a way to start a Monday. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Feedback. You're on Air Town Square here on the Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders, along with Sean Tansky. And our phone number is here, 610-374-8800, or toll-free, 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text line, if you want to text us your opinion, is 484-650-3373, and our email address is feedback at 830weeu.com. All right, let's take a look at today's top three topics on this, yes, tax day. If you haven't already filed your taxes, today's the deadline, so you better get it done. Anyway, today's top three topics are, does Iran's attack on Israel show that the Biden administration has lost control of the conflict? One foreign policy expert tends to think so. We'll talk about that. We'll explain why that expert thinks that's the way it is. A Berks County municipality says it will pay the emergency medical service needs of all its residents. And that leads to the question, should all municipalities offer this benefit? And how difficult will it be to pick a jury for Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial in a city of strong opinions? I'm referring to New York City. And April is Alcohol Awareness Month. And coming up at 11 o'clock, I'll be joined by folks from the Council on Chemical Abuse to discuss alcohol abuse and its costs on families and communities. All right, with that said, let's get started. Normally, I start off with lighter stuff, but I'm just going to get right to what's going on out there in the Middle East, given what happened over the weekend. So let's start with this article from the Wall Street Journal, whose headline reads, President Biden got the Middle East regional war he sought to avoid. So here's what they report. It's not an op-ed piece. It's an article. And it reads as follows here. Let's see. I want to get myself started here because I also have a soundbite I want to share with you on this one. President Biden's cardinal objective since the outset of the Gaza conflict in October has been to prevent a wider war in the Middle East. On Saturday, he got the escalation he sought to avoid. Iran fired more than 300 drones and missiles, marking the first time that Tehran has directly attacked Israel. Is that Rashida Tlaib I'm hearing? Oh no, those are crickets. I'm sorry. With that barrage, Iran has set aside the veneer of deniability it has long tried to exploit by supporting regional proxies. The direct attack forces Israel to confront the question of how to respond militarily and presents the Biden administration with the challenge of finding a way to avert the larger regional conflict it has long feared. For now, the Biden administration is hoping that international political pressure on Iran and quiet suasion with Israel, which has become increasingly dependent on U.S.-led air and missile defense protection for the security, will dial down tensions. Yet, even if escalation can be avoided in the coming hours and days, the U.S. and its foremost Middle East ally will have to grapple with a volatile region that increasingly requires American political and military involvement, despite the White House's early hopes to shift its attention to Asia. Again, I'm reading directly from the Wall Street Journal. Norman Rule, who served as a top U.S. intelligence official on Iran, is quoted in this article as saying the following. The Middle East has changed. The red line that Israel and Iran would not directly attack the other country is now erased. Rule went on to say each country will now claim they can use this option in response to security threats, although any future attacks may not be on this scale. Well, for decades, Iran has primarily worked through a network of Middle East proxies in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen, as it sought to avoid a full-scale conventional conflict with the U.S. and Israel. And we talked about those proxies one of the last times that Dr. Timothy Blessing was in here. In a statement Saturday night, Iran made clear that its barrage wasn't intended as the opening phase of a new conventional war, but was punishment for the April 1st Israeli airstrike against top Iranian paramilitary commanders in Damascus earlier this month. With that notice, Iran has offered, or was offering, to end the current round of open hostilities between Israel and Tehran on its terms and putting the ball in Israel's court. Biden's counsel to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a Saturday night call was that this was a time for careful reflection. Israel, Biden argued, had come out ahead. Israel had killed Islamic Revolutionary Guard leaders in its Damascus strike, while Iran's missile and drone attacks had been largely neutralized. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby appeared on Fox News Sunday yesterday to discuss the current situation in the Middle East, and here's what he had to say.
It's going to be up to the Israelis to decide what the next step is here. I will just say this. President Biden, since the beginning of this conflict, has worked very hard to keep this from becoming a broader regional war.
Well, meanwhile, CNN reports that Iran has warned that it will respond with more force if Israel retaliates over this past weekend's strikes, which Tehran says were themselves a reply to the Israeli attack earlier this month on its embassy complex in Damascus. Their statement went on to say the Islamic Republic of Iran will not hesitate to exercise its inherent right of self-defense when required. That is a statement from Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the UN. The statement also criticizes the United Nations Security Council for failing to uphold international peace, allowing Israel to breach established international norms and escalate regional tensions. I find that rather hilarious, given the fact that it was Iran through Hamas that started this whole nonsense back on October 7th of last year. Remember that? That was okay in Iran's eyes, but this was not, apparently. Well, then there's Business Insider that has an interesting article with the headline, "Iran Strike on Israel Shows How the Biden Administration Has Lost Control of the Conflict," according to at least one foreign policy expert. So let's see what who this foreign policy expert is and what they have to say. This again from Business Insider. Iran's barrage of attacks against Israel represents a stark reminder of how the U.S. has been unable to ameliorate tensions in the Middle East and contain the ongoing conflict in Gaza, a national security and foreign policy expert told Business Insider. The U.S. anticipated that Iran would strike back, but it was only a matter of when and how. President Joe Biden told reporters on Friday that he expected Iran to attack Israel sooner rather than later. The president also reaffirmed U.S. support for Israel and had a simple brief message to Iran: don't. Well, Iran's brazen dismissal of Biden's warning may be the result of a series of inconsistent strategic moves from the U.S. with its handling of the Israeli-Gaza war. Sean McFate, a national security and foreign policy expert at Syracuse's University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs, told Business Insider. McFate told Business Insider that Iran's retaliation was a way to show the international stage that the country had a backbone after Israel's airstrike in Damascus. And more broadly, Saturday's attack shows just how effective Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel was by stoking chaos in the Middle East, McFate said. Hamas launched this as a way to disrupt the melting of relations between Israel and the Gulf states, McFate said, referring to how diplomatic relations between Israel and Arab countries had been thawing before the war. Biden similarly stated that Hamas was trying to disrupt his administration's efforts to normalize ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia, as well as others in the region, the Washington Post reported. With the war in Gaza, the U.S. wedged itself into the battle and has so far shown conflicting messages to the world through its military support for Israel and simultaneous humanitarian aid for Gaza, leaving Gulf countries such as Iran to feel more defensive, this expert says. The fact that the Biden administration is both arming Israel and sending aid to Gaza shows the world that the Biden team has no strategic competence, McFate said. They've already lost control, referring to the Biden administration. McFate pointed to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war as another example of one of Biden administration's strategic misfires. Throughout the 2024 election cycle, Biden has said that the U.S. must maintain its support for Ukraine against Russian aggression. But the president's support for Israel runs counter to the reasons he said the U.S. should support Ukraine. McFate said the following: "The administration wants to be the firefighters in a raging house fire. But I think for them to do that, they need to extend more leverage on the government of Israel by conditioning further military support. Israel has basically said, drop off your munitions, don't answer the door, just leave, like your Uber driver. I think the administration has been a little too timid in how to deal with Israel." Again, I'm quoting from McFate, this foreign policy expert. In recent weeks, U.S. support for Israel showed some signs of wavering as Biden called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza during a call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, according to the White House. In a Saturday statement after Iran's strikes, Biden condemned the attacks and said he had spoken with Netanyahu over the phone to say that the U.S. remains steadfast in its support for Israel. Biden said the following: "I've just spoken with Prime Minister Netanyahu to reaffirm America's ironclad commitment to the security of Israel." Maybe Mr. Biden should tell that to his own party members. He said, "I told him that Israel demonstrated a remarkable capacity to defend against and defeat even unprecedented attacks, sending a clear message to its foes that they cannot effectively threaten the security of Israel." However, in the same call, Biden told the prime minister that the U.S. will oppose a counterattack against Iran, according to a senior official who told CNN. A White House spokesman did not immediately respond to a request for comment from Business Insider on this article. So what do you think? Do you agree with this policy, this political foreign policy expert who says that the Biden administration has lost control of the conflict? 610-374-8800, toll free, 888-401-0459. And while we're at it, let's talk about the G7 leaders who met immediately following this attack. I got this from The Hill. The G7 leaders warned Sunday that the Iranian attack on Israel risks an uncontrollable regional escalation. With its actions, Iran has further stepped toward the destabilization of the region and risks provoking an uncontrollable regional escalation. This must be avoided. We will continue to work to stabilize the situation and avoid further escalation. In this spirit, the G7 leaders said, we demand that Iran and its proxies cease their attacks, and we stand ready to take further measures now and in response to further destabilizing initiatives. The G7 leaders condemned the direct and unprecedented attack launched by Iran in their statement and emphasized their full solidarity and support to Israel. The leaders also noted that they will continue to work to end the ongoing crisis in Gaza, where Israel has been targeting Hamas militants in response to the October 7th attack on Israel. They said in their statement, we will also strengthen our cooperation to end the crisis in Gaza, including by continuing to work towards an immediate and sustainable ceasefire and the release of hostages by Hamas, and deliver increased humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in need. All right, so that gives you some update there. And before I go any farther, let me just share this one with you. J.D. Vance is a senator, a Republican senator from Ohio. And he said yesterday that the U.S. should focus more on itself and its closest allies, such as Israel, instead of sending more aid to Ukraine. Vance has been opposed to sending additional aid to Ukraine in its war against Russia, writing in a New York Times op-ed piece on Friday that more funding for the embattled nation will not change the outcome of the war, which he believes Ukraine can't win. He said on CNN's State of the Union with host Jake Tapper that the U.S. needs to focus on rebuilding its industrial base instead. Here are his remarks on CNN.
Ask you about Ukraine, because you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that you don't think it makes sense, the Biden pitch for aid to Ukraine. You've been accused of appeasement. You've been accused of surrender. Even the National Review had a column about that. And again, I'm going to get to Iran and Israel, which I know is a big pressing story. But I do want you to address that, because the National Review is basically saying that your solution to the problem of Russia invading a sovereign nation, Ukraine, is to just surrender. Are they wrong?
No, look, my solution to the problem is to rebuild our own country. The reason that we're in this position, Jake, is because we're stretched way too thin. We're stretched way too thin. And the number of weapon systems that we need, that Ukraine needs, that Taiwan needs, that Israel needs, and we can't do all of these things at once. So when you're stretched too thin, you've got to focus and you've got to rebuild your own country. Let's take just one of those weapon systems that we're talking about, 155-millimeter artillery shells. The Russians currently have a 5-to-1 advantage over the Ukrainians. The Israelis will need this stuff. The Taiwanese need this stuff. And of course, America needs this stuff. Can we possibly fight all of those conflicts at once? No, the math just doesn't make sense. So what we should be doing is, with Ukraine, encouraging them to take a defensive posture, not these disastrous counteroffensive the Biden administration has been promoting.
The counteroffensive is within Ukraine, though. The counteroffensive is within Ukraine. They're not seeking land from Russia. In fact, I'm not
passing judgment on the morality of what they're doing. Of course, it's their territory, Jake, but you have to acknowledge military reality on the ground. If they're going to waste a ton of money, a ton of lives, and a ton of ammunition on a counteroffensive strategy, but a defensive strategy might actually work, we've got to choose the strategy that might actually work.
But the counteroffensive is within Ukrainian territory. Just today, Zelensky was suggesting that the strike by Iran on Israel should serve as a wake-up call in terms of this greater battle. And maybe you disagree with people who see it this way, between autocracies and democracies, Israel being a democracy, as is Ukraine, Iran and Russia being autocracies. What do you say to that?
Well, I think foreign policy is not a nursery rhyme, and it should serve as a wake-up call, but it should serve as a wake-up call that we have to rebuild our own industrial base. Let's take another weapon system that's really important. The Patriot Interceptor system almost definitely saved a lot of Israeli lives last night. The Ukrainians want thousands of those per year. Do you know how many we manufacture in a year, Jake? 550. We cannot possibly, I've repeated this for years now, we cannot possibly support Ukraine and Israel and our own defense needs in the way that these guys demand. So I think we should focus. I think Israel is a much closer ally, is a much more core American national security interest. And of course, we've got to focus on ourselves. That means encouraging the Ukrainians to take a defensive strategy. This is really important, Jake, because you're going to hear a lot of calls across Washington, D.C., that we now have to pass this supplemental.
Right.
But if we pass the Ukraine and Israel supplemental and send a ton of weapons to Ukraine that the Israelis need, we're actually weakening Israel in the name of helping them. It doesn't make any sense.
Well,
it ignores mathematical reality.
The supplemental, which your leader, Senator McConnell, has called on the House to pass, the supplemental contains money for Israel and Ukraine and Taiwan. So it's not a question of either or, it's a question of both.
I think it is a question of either or, Jay, because it's not about the money again, it's about the weapons. If we pass the supplemental, we go from making 550 Patriot Interceptors to 650. That's 100 more, and the world needs thousands of these things. So really, it goes back to the basic math of this. If you don't make enough weapons to fight three wars, you've got to figure out how to focus. And my proposal is we focus on ourselves and we focus on our closest allies.
That's J.D. Vance, Senator J.D. Vance, a Republican from Ohio, appearing on CNN with Jake Tapper over the weekend. Does he make sense? Do you agree with what Vance says about the need to provide resources primarily to your main ally in the Middle East at this point, Israel, because of the fact that it's very difficult for us to reestablish our military materiel if we are trying to support two wars that are going on simultaneously. Wars, by the way, that we are not directly involved in, I might add, at least not yet. All right, we're going to talk more about the Middle East in just a bit and talk about what GOP lawmakers are calling for. And are Democrats having a change of heart about Israel? That and more when this Monday edition of Feedback continues. Stay with us.
News you can use.
I feel more informed when I listen.
News Talk 830, WEEU.
The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback. You're on air, Town Square. Our phone number is here if you'd like to take part in the program. 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text line is 484-650-3373. And our email address is feedback@830weeu.com. Well, Republicans are weighing in on what happened over the weekend. I got this from Mediaite. On Saturday, they demanded the U.S. launch a retaliatory strike against Iran for the drone and missile attack that was launched against Israel. Following the attack, Representative Steve Scalise, a Republican from Louisiana, announced the House will move forward this week to consider a bill that will provide Israel with an aid package. He says, in light of Iran's unjustified attack on Israel, the House will move from its previously announced legislative schedule to instead consider legislation that supports our ally Israel and holds Iran and its terrorist proxies accountable, he wrote on X. The House of Representatives stands strongly with Israel, he says, and there must be consequences for this unprovoked attack. Then there's Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who praised the decision by House leadership while adding that Iran must face consequences for attacking a U.S. ally. Prayers for our ally Israel, who's under attack by the Ayatollah and his henchmen. It is long past time for Iran to pay a heavy price for the terrorism they sow throughout the world, Graham wrote on X. He went on to write, I'm glad to see the House will take up the Israel aid package this week and hope they'll do the same for Ukraine, making it a loan as President Trump suggested. He added, and I quote, the world is a dangerous place, and we have to show resolve for our friends and determination against our enemies. Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee also took to X, formerly known as Twitter, to demand Biden launch an immediate, aggressive, retaliatory strike on Iran. So that's the Republican take on this. The Daily News out of New York has an interesting article on the Democrats. And it asked the question, are Democrats changing their tune when it comes to Israel? Here's what the Daily News is reporting. The debate is no longer simply about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Gaza, but rather about Israel facing Tehran's Ayatollahs and Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Mainstream Democratic skepticism toward Israel has suddenly grown muted. Take Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who said the following. I condemn the Iranian attack on Israel and support Israel's right to defend itself against this aggression. He tweeted that within hours after Iran launched its barrage. He went on to say in that tweet, I also stand with POTUS, the President of the United States, in seeking to prevent an even wider conflict that engulfs the people of the entire region. Well, just days earlier, Van Hollen mulled blocking $18 billion worth of F-15 jets for Israel. Here's what he said at the time. I was glad to see the president, at least as reported out, finally say to Netanyahu that if you don't follow these, you know my requests, that there will be consequences. He said little more than a week ago on CBS's Face the Nation. Well, Van Hollen isn't alone in shifting toward the political center. Also on Saturday night, Nancy Pelosi, the former House Speaker, returned to her traditional role as a backer of Israel by saying on Twitter the following, America's support for Israel's security is resolved as we condemn Iran's horrible attacks. She went on to say in her post on X, our commitment to the Israeli people and support of their defense remains unwavering. Really? And we must pass the Senate's National Security Supplemental. Well, that's good to know, writes the Daily News. Days earlier, she had joined 39 other Democratic House members in calling for a halt to U.S. military aid to Israel. So what is this about her saying that their support remains unwavering? She went on to say, in light of the recent strike against aid workers and the ever-worsening humanitarian crisis, we believe it is unjustifiable to approve these weapons transfers. This, I'm reading from the letter that Pelosi joined with 39 other Democratic House members in writing a few days ago. Other signatories included squad members Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Michigan's, Rashida Tlaib, Missouri's Cori Bush, Minnesota's Ilhan Omar, and New York's beleaguered Jamal Bowman. Previously, Bush, Omar, and Tlaib opposed U.S. funding Israel's Iron Dome. You can always count on them to be against Israel. For his part, Bowman faces a primary challenge from Westchester County Executive George Latimer. The latest poll places the congressman down by double digits, and he's not alone. Some of the other members of the squad are also facing troubles in their respective primaries. In case anyone forgot, Bowman's colleagues censured him for pulling a fire alarm in a House office building when there was no fire. For the record, Bowman subsequently pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor regarding that case. Not everyone, however, has undergone a change of heart. Saturday afternoon saw 300 anti-war activists packed into a Teamsters Union Hall out there in Chicago, the site of the Democrats' August convention. There they learned how to chant death to America and death to Israel. And they did it in Farsi, the Free Press reported. It's really inspiring to see that people are just as enthusiastic and maybe even more enthusiastic to march on the DNC as they are to march on the RNC, according to one activist. We can thank Genocide Joe and our movement for that. Meanwhile, there has been absolutely nothing from Rashida Tlaib on Iran's attack Saturday. How come that comes as no surprise to me? All right, we'll go to the phones in just a bit. Tony in Exeter, hang in there. I'll take your call right after this next commercial break. You're listening to Feedback. You're on air Town Square on this Monday morning, and I thank you for that. Stay with us.
Serving Collegeville, North Wales, King of Prussia, and all of Montgomery County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
Welcome back to Feedback on this Monday morning on the Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Let's go to the phones. Tony in Exeter wants to weigh in on the attack by Iran over the weekend. Tony, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Hi, Bill. Hey, you know what? What really surprised me the most was how the allies responded to that attack from Iran. I was glad to see that. I was even surprised to see that, the UK was involved. Of course, the U.S. was in there. Even Saudi Arabia came to help shoot down some of those drones, and so did Jordan. And that amazes me, and I love it. I love that they stuck together. We need more of that. And the problem is we would have more of that, and we wouldn't even have the problem in the Middle East, you know, if it wasn't for Biden's policies. That's really what that started this whole debacle. It's just a shame. But I was really impressed with the part, you know, how the allies stuck together. That's really why I called you, because and especially Saudi Arabia. And, you know, on Fox News and different news stations, they talk to individuals about some experts in the Middle East. And they actually said that because of Trump's Abraham Accords, things were more stable. And it actually brought Iran, not Iran, but the Saudi Arabia and Israel closer together. They weren't totally there yet, but they were on the move to become more friendly. They wanted to work together economically and everything. And I don't think we're losing it yet, because it's my understanding from what I've been hearing that Saudi Arabia wants to continue to try to build a friendship and have peace in the Middle East. And you know something, Bill? I'm going to tell you something. And you know from when I call in, I don't pull any punches. I try to stay respectful. It is what it is. Joe Biden is just not a good president. He lacks leadership. He has no common sense. He's just really a not, as far as being the president of the United States and also the leader of the free world, he is just not intelligent enough for it. It is what it is. I mean, we have going on 3.5 years. It's almost it's a fact on a lot of different policies that took place. We see it with our own eyes. And you know something, Bill? You mentioned something about Iran in one of your articles there, that Iran has the right to respond. Certainly, they had the right to respond. But then I think, and you know, I don't put words in anybody's mouth, but I think you kind of chuckled, and I agree with you on this, that they said that they had every right to respond. Well, you know something, Bill? Iran would not even be in the picture had it not been for what Joe Biden's policies has done to create this problem. Once again, I will quote what Obama says, never underestimate Joe Biden to F things up. And Joe Biden has shown that to the world.
Well, in what way? Now this has been a historical conflict, so to speak, between Israel and a good part of the Middle East for many years.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can lay the blame solely on Joe Biden here.
Well, let me take it a step further then, Bill. I will lay the blame on Joe Biden 100% on the issue with Iran, the country of Iran, 100%. So you and I disagree on this. Joe Biden has caused Iran to become powerful again. He gave them $6 billion. He lifted the sanctions on them. All that Trump had done, and it doesn't, once again, I want to stress to the people out there that listen, because they get sick of hearing about Trump. It happened to be Trump. If it wasn't Trump, it could have been any president. But Trump had Iran on their heels. They were broke. He had them. They couldn't eat. They couldn't do anything. They were not a threat. He lowered the threat level with them. Joe Biden came back in, put them back in power, gave them money, lifted the sanctions. They're supplying oil to China and Russia. They are billionaires once again. And what was the money used for primarily? And they'll still argue the point and lie. These Democrats will lie on the camera and say the money's not going to terrorists, the Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas. That's where they're putting that money. It's not going to their people. And if it is, maybe they throw them a dog bone or something. But the money is going into the terrorist groups. So
All right. Hold on for just a minute, Tony. You said that none of this was going on under Trump, and I'm paraphrasing you there. How confident are you that Iran was not in any way, shape, or form continuing to develop a nuclear weapon while Trump was in the White House?
They could have been doing that. They could have been doing it. They could be doing it right now. So could North Korea. They could do it. What you do in your house, I don't know what you're doing. Yes, they could be doing it. But there's procedures and sanctions and things that can be done to prohibit this. And Trump, or once again, any other president, but Trump already has a four-year record. He proved what he can do. He was a working president. He accomplished things. So there would be things are different with the kind of leadership you have. We have poor leadership right now. We have no leadership right now. Joe Biden talks out of both sides of his mouth. One day he's for Israel. The next day he's not really for Israel. And then the next day he's wants to do this, and then he doesn't want to do this. He's looking for votes, and even before the votes, the man is an empty suit. And it's a sin that we have him running the country. And you know something, Bill? I'm sticking to what I said earlier, 100%. These problems are taking place because of Joe Biden's policies, and the vice president's not much better. And that's why we're in the mess we're in.
All right, wrap
and
it up now.
And one thing in this, and it, all right, Bill, this is a fact. Over in the Middle East, things were a lot calmer when Trump was in office. The world was more tranquil. It wasn't perfect, but it was 100% better with the leadership of Donald Trump. And we don't we need someone like him to take this country back. You know, and that's the only one I see out there.
All right, wrap it up. Wrap it up.
Truly for the American people is Trump, Bill. So
all right, Tony. All right, thanks for the call.
All right, thank you, Bill.
All right, bye bye now. Yeah, please try to stay within 5 minutes, unless I interrupt you, and then I do give you a few extra minutes. But try and keep your remarks to 5 minutes. I would appreciate that. All right, do I have time for this? Let me see here. Yeah, I'm going to hold off on that until the next hour. I'm going to hold off until the next hour as well. But here's something that I saw over the weekend. It's separate from the Middle East situation, and it's something local. And I saw this on Facebook over the weekend. The Wyomissing Borough Police Department posted this on Facebook. So let me read it directly to you. Wyomissing Borough Council has approved the borough paying the membership fees to Western Berks EMS for anyone who lives in the borough of Wyomissing. That means if you live in the borough and are in need of emergency medical services, you will not have to pay for their services. In addition, any borough of Wyomissing resident needing EMS while outside the borough will not have to pay for those services from other EMS providers as well. So this raises the question, should every municipality do this for their residents? So that if you need an ambulance, you won't have to pay for that service because the borough or the municipality you live in would pick it up, would pick up the cost of that. Or if they just come to your residence to provide some medical aid to you. Again, it would be free to you because the municipality would pick that up. Is that something that local government should be doing? I applaud Wyomissing for doing this. I don't know what impact it's going to have on their local taxes, but I do applaud the borough for making this service available to their residents. So I throw this out to you. Would you like to see this happen in your municipality? I don't know if other municipalities are doing it, to be honest with you. I saw this post over the weekend, and I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. So I'm going to throw it out to you and see what you have to say about it, and we'll talk about it the next hour at 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. By the way, we've got a couple of people coming on this week that I want to bring to your attention. There's a brand-new third party out. In fact, you're going to see their candidates on the ballot in November, and I'm referring to the Forward Party. And they are fielding a couple of candidates for statewide offices. And tomorrow, I'm going to have the political director for Pennsylvania's Forward Party on, Craig Snyder. He'll be with me during the 10 o'clock hour tomorrow. Then on Friday, Dr. Timothy Blessing will be here again at the 10 o'clock hour on Friday. Now, our initial conversation was that he was going to talk about third-party candidates and how they can muddle an election. Muddle being his words again. But given what's happened over the weekend, we may change that topic of conversation. I'll keep you posted on that a little bit later on after I have a discussion with Tim on that. So that gives you some ideas to what's coming up this week here on Feedback. You're on air Town Square on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Stay with us.
Serving Bethel, Hamburg, Birdsboro, and all of Berks County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
The voice of Berks and beyond.
Anyway, I'm glad that we don't have any rain today. Oh, at least for the next couple of days. I think rain comes back on Wednesday. Oh, my. It is April, after all. April showers. Yeah, I know. I know. We're going to break for news right now with Radio PA and ABC. And Bob McCool will have a check on sports for you to round out the top of the hour here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Stay with us. Hour number two of feedback comes your way in just a bit.
The Voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back as we kick off hour number two of this Monday edition of Feedback. You're on air, Town Square, on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders, along with producer Sean Tansky. And our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. Well, the Telegraph has an interesting piece in their publication today that I'd like to get your take on. The headline reads, "The West Must Remember How to Fight. It May Already Be Too Late." It's written by Zoe Strimple, and here's what Ms. Strimple has to write. "On the good things about being a citizen of the West is that since the last World War ended in 1945, most men's survival has not been imperiled by the need to go and fight in massive wars." Somebody needs to remind her of Vietnam. "We do not have to kiss goodbye to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of beloved sons, friends, fathers, or brothers. We have a professional army, are accustomed to relatively small casualty numbers when that army does go into combat, and bar periodic terror attacks, we're generally able to get on with the business of living miserably or prosperously, but living. Less lovely is the corollary of this comfort, the moral decrepitude and cowardice that is sunk deep into our psyches. We're too narcissistic and bored, too cosseted and ill-focused to be collectively courageous or warlike. This has been devastating for the trajectory of the whole world in general and catastrophic for the safety, security, and prosperity of the West. How did we get to this perilous pass? The answer is that we have spent the past decades focusing on made-up threats and burying our heads in the sand. We've elected leaders and created political, policy, and educational elites who have willfully pretended that the real threats, Islamists, global jihadi movements, their regime funders in Iran, and the unvetted influx to Europe of migrants from countries steeped in their evil ethos are just the fever dreams of a racist and backward fringe. In so doing, we've picked apart the rationale of robust defense, which sometimes involves the need to attack and to die in doing so. By discrediting Western interventionism and military might, we have not made the world a nicer, cozier, more just place. We've merely given a green light to monsters happy to die if it means killing more of us. And so, as Israel enters yet another month of bombardment from terror groups on all sides, with a dwindling number of hostages still alive in Gaza, and anti-Semitic displays getting bolder every day in Britain and the U.S., I find that my patience is at an all-time low for the faux establishment, or faux astonishment and passive consternation of the prospect of Iran, a rogue state on the brink of being a nuclear power directly attacking Israel. Israel, after all, is one of the few countries left in the civilized world, a member of that tiny number that includes Ukraine, that still understands the devastating but necessary calculus of military power. The chain of events that would follow any assault by Tehran would begin with a sturdy and, one expects, devastating military response. At times like these, we don't need proclamations of dismay from our leaders. We need action. The hour is already advanced, and still, the fast-dwindling powers of the West do nothing. With Iran, Obama seemed to work as hard as he could to keep his head in the sand, pretending that his laughable deal would somehow change Iran's spots and convince it to put on hold its ambitions to be the most evilly powerful regime in the world. Trump cut off the bargain, and while Biden tried to keep it on life support, it now appears to be dead. That hasn't stopped the White House freeing up billions of dollars that Iran has been able to use to fund its nuclear program and its proxies, including Hamas. Leaked documents this week appear to show how Tehran sent hundreds of millions of dollars to groups from 2014. Meanwhile, Britain's response to the Iranian threat has been lily-livered. We have refused to cut off diplomatic relations with Tehran. And more bewilderingly, refused to proscribe its Revolutionary Guard as a terror group for fear of provoking the regime. This is despite threats to Iranians on British soil. The U.S. and the U.K. have let Iran's proxies get away with violence for decades. But since October 7th, there have been direct hits with the Houthis' bombardment of our shipping vessels in the Red Sea. And instead of roaring with rage, we prefer to turn the other cheek. We seem to have done our best to defang our military, whittling down the appeal of our armed forces so that even many of those who do apply end up giving up before even getting to basic training because recruitment is so rife with delays. We have the smallest number of combat personnel in modern history, and the focus in the armed forces, as elsewhere, seems to be as much on diversity, tick-boxing, as on preparing for war, offering credible deference. All of this, and the mindset that has allowed it to happen, has helped embolden Putin and Xi Jinping, and literally helped to arm Iran, with Israel paying the awful price. Yet instead of thanking and helping Jerusalem as it takes on the ogre of the Middle East, we snipe at it, lecture it, and threaten it, thinking how enough to moot cutting off arms sales in its hour of need. Will we wake up in time? We need to relearn the vital importance of the West's role, and particularly that of the Anglosphere, in maintaining the balance of power that keeps us from global reversion to bloodthirsty servitude, religious mania, and authoritarianism. Our leaders must stop misleading platitudes about fighting racism and Islamophobia and get real, acknowledging that it's partly our fault that Iran, Afghanistan, and Russia have become what they have, and that it's in our gift to stave off the threat posed by their regimes. But to do that, we'd actually have to remember what war is for and the sacrifice it requires. We would have to be willing to send some to die for the sake of good against evil, right against wrong, the West against horror and despotism. We would have to be willing to kill for that, too. Those of us who lack physical courage need the courage of our convictions. And at the moment, many of those convictions are deeply and terrifyingly wrong. Zoe Strimple with a piece that appears in the Telegraph with the headline, "The West Must Remember How to Fight. It May Already Be Too Late." Is she right? Let us know. Let's go to the phones right now. Speak with Irene in Burnville. Irene, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about the ambulance.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, it's like you always say, anything that's free isn't free. You know, because when you think about who's going to be paying for it, be mostly the homeowners.
Yeah, that's when I said, remember I said that I don't know what impact it's going to have on the local taxes?
Okay, I missed that part.
Yeah, that...
I yawned.
No, that's quite all right. Yeah, that's why I added that caveat there, is that I don't know what impact this would have on the taxes that residents of Wyomissing will have to pay. But what are your overall thoughts on this? Do you think it's a worthwhile cause or no?
Now that you said it, I'm thinking a little bit more. Maybe in Wyomissing it won't be that bad because they have a lot of businesses here that might help absorb some of the taxes. But in places where there's a lot of renters and, you know, a lot of homeowners and not many businesses, the taxes would have to go up to pay for it.
Like rural areas, I assume you're referring to, right? Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I'd rather just pay my own end, you know, instead of paying it through the township.
And those fees can be steep. I mean, I know that for a fact, at least down in Pottstown, because I had to have an ambulance come and help me a while ago, back in 2019. And the fee that I incurred for them coming to my condo was wow, it was crazy.
I think if you join the ambulance every year, you just pay that flat fee.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure how, you know, otherwise, but for regular ambulance, they actually, that's the only thing you pay. They accept what the insurance sends them, and you don't have to pay anything else out of pocket.
Gotcha.
But I don't know how it works, like, if you have to call a helicopter or something like that.
So the bottom line is, you're against it or for it?
I like I said, I'd rather pay my own, you know, ambulance, you know, fees every year and not worry about my taxes going up.
Okay. Well, I thank you for sharing your opinion with us today.
All right.
You take care, Irene. Enjoy this beautiful day, okay?
Okay, I will.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. 610-374-8800, toll-free, 888-401-0459. Again, she was referring to, Irene, that is, was referring to a post that I saw on Facebook that was written by the Wyomissing Borough Police Department, stating that the borough council there had recently approved paying the ambulance fees for all residents of the borough, even if they use an ambulance outside of the borough. So I'm asking for your opinion on that. Is that something that that other municipalities should do, provide a free service like that? And of course, like I said, I don't know what the impact will be on Wyomissing's taxes as a result of doing that. But I ask you, is that a service that we should be providing as a community for everybody who lives in the community? Let me know. Well, Cheryl Chumley, whose column I have read in the past on the show here, she's with the Washington Times, has an interesting piece out with the headline, "The Stupidity of the Two-State Solution for Israel and Palestinians." So here's what Ms. Chumley writes this time. Imagine a group of thugs break into your home, rape your daughter, murder your son, and run off with your baby after setting fire to all your belongings. And then, a week after helping bring to justice the perpetrators, the local media and political leaders give up and demand you instead sit down and strike a deal with your attackers, that you agree to coexist peacefully alongside them, so long as they agree to give back your baby. Would you say, hey, now what a great deal or a great idea? That's what the leftists and world powers are advocating for Israel. Scarcely a month after the Hamas terror attacks on Israel, the narrative of poor Jews has shifted to that of poor Palestinians and poor Palestinian civilians and poor Palestinian children. The narrative has shifted so that the Palestinians under the Hamas terror they voted into office, have become the victims of the Israeli oppressors, the victims of a world that has not given them the land they want, the land they say they deserve, the land they say the Jewish nation is unjustly occupying. The narrative has shifted so that the thousands of murdered, killed, injured, abducted, and grievously damaged Israeli citizens, civilians, men, women, children, babies, and IDF soldiers, so that these innocents are not so much innocents as rightful casualties of a long-running war, and that if Israel wants to stop this long-running war and get the other side to lay down arms and commit to peace, all Israel has to do is agree to destroy its people and its nation. That's the mentality the two-staters think they can persuade with logic, facts, and logical, factual appeals to common sense and mutual interests. The problem, of course, is that the Israelis want to live, and the terrorists want them to die. And it's tough to find the mutually agreed upon common ground to bridge those divides. President Joe Biden, Politico wrote back in January, said he believed a two-state solution between the Israelis and Palestinians could still happen even with the current Israeli government, meaning Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in power. This from The Hill back in March, and I quote, Senate Democrats press Biden to establish two-state solution for Israel and Palestine. The story went on to say that 19 Democrats under the leadership of Senator Tom Carper wrote to Biden to push him to bring about a bold public framework that recognizes a non-militarized Palestinian state and to reignite U.S. leadership on a diplomatic solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Writes Ms. Chumley. If Carper's home were busted into and his daughter raped and his son murdered and his baby taken hostage, would a bold public framework for a diplomatic solution make sense? So much less for Israel. It's easy to be a politician a light year away from war, living in the comfort of cocktails at 5 and catered meals at 7, with armed security forces standing guard a discreet distance away, and an armored or tinted window vehicle parked with a waiting driver in the street and calling for peace. Peace. Lay down those weapons and talk. It's easy to discuss peace for others who are at war. But in the House of Israel, Hamas was the intruder, the murderer, the rapist, the abductor. Most of the Israelis who wanted peace with the Palestinians and provided peace-loving gestures to their Gaza neighbors, i.e. food, medical care, transportation, friendship, had their eyes ripped wide open on October 7th of last year, when Hamas terrorists attacked and then again when the Palestinians in Gaza cheered Hamas attacks, and then again and again even now, when Palestinians in Gaza continue to support the Hamas attacks against Israelis. Yeah, these are the same Palestinians that Rashida Tlaib and those people who took part in that rally in Michigan chanting, "Death to America, death to Israel," are in support of. Peace with Palestinians, writes Ms. Chumley. Too many government, military, and civilian sources in Israel point to the tunnels that were discovered under Palestinian homes, as well as the machines of war like RPGs that were discovered under the beds in Palestinian homes as evidence of the inability of these so-called innocent civilians to carve out a peace with Jews position in their hearts. Evil just doesn't turn its cheek so easily. Evil needs to be dominated, subdued, and utterly destroyed in order for peace to come. The only real solution is a two-state solution, the U.S. Department of State posted in a YouTube video about a month ago. Biden, only Gaza's solution is a two-state solution, NBC News posted in a YouTube video about a month ago. A two-state solution means death to Israel, followed by death to America, followed by death to the West. That's the chant. Those are the words. Those are the phrases of one side of the two-state equation. And here's a hint. It ain't Israel. The solution to peace in the Middle East is to destroy the forces that are stirring the terror, kill the terrorists, obliterate the terror organizations, destroy the ability of those who fund terrorism, like Iran, to fund terrorism. Then, and only then, will peace prevail. That seems a common-sense agenda this White House should be able to back and support. That Team Biden doesn't only send the clear message to the world that America, under this administration, stands with terrorists almost as much, nearly as much, heck, maybe just as much as with Israel. That's all the terrorists need to know to continue their terrorist ways. Cheryl Chumley in the Washington Times. Her piece is titled "The Stupidity of the Two-State Solution for Israel and Palestinians." With that, we'll take a break, and the Monday edition of Feedback will continue in just a bit.
Serving Paoli, Glenmore, Coatesville, and all of Chester County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Ah, Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose bringing us out of that commercial break here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Welcome back to Feedback. You're on Air Town Square. Let's go to the phones right now. Let's head to Leesport and talk with Bob this morning. Bob, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, just one comment about the free ambulance service. Like I think Irene brought up, you know, somebody's paying for it. And if you make something free, you know what that does. Makes people more free to think they can use it. And for perhaps frivolous reasons, I only think that ambulance calls will increase proportionally to the amount of, government subsidizing of it that we do. It's just one of those things, supply and demand. So think about those ideas, too, when before you agree everybody in Berks County should get free ambulance service without insurance paying for it.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to bring that up before I talk about what's going on in the Middle East. And there, Tony was right in the fact that by allowing Iran to be funded again, Biden has just emboldened the most radical of the Muslim sects. I guess you're familiar with the difference between the Sunni Arabs and the Shia Arabs. I mean, the Shia Muslims mm-hmm. and the Sunni Muslims. The Sunnis are the ones who believe in the traditions of the Prophet and electing a caliph or successor from the most politically significant families on the Arabian Peninsula. That's how that Sunni or Orthodox position got started. On the other hand, you had the Shia, who became extraordinarily angry and violent after the forthrightly guided caliph Hussein Ali was assassinated in Karbala, of all places. That's in modern-day Iraq. And when the Shia go there, oftentimes they're attacked by Sunnis. The two groups hate each other. And I'm going perhaps into the weeds and explaining this, but, you know, Hussein Ali gave rise to the idea, his assassination gave rise to the idea of the sect of the Prophet, and that's what Shia is. They believe that it should be descendants of Muhammad who are the rightly guided leaders of the religion of Islam. But besides those divisions, you have this more radical group, the Shia, who and they are the ones who sponsor the proxies of Hamas and Hezbollah and the like. And when they go on their pilgrimage to Karbala, they oftentimes bloody themselves. And they love the idea of martyrdom. They want to die as a sign of their faithfulness to their martyred caliph who was assassinated and died too. So I'm just saying, when you give money to a group like that, who is, it's got one purpose, and that is to kill Jews and retake the Middle East and reestablish the empire of Islam throughout that part of the world, you're feeding into radical ideas. And of course, what Trump had done, I'm sure it wasn't he himself, but his Pompeo and the Secretary of State, they had isolated the Shia Iranians with the Abraham Accords, and they had gotten the Saudi Arabians, who are Sunnis, and the Jordanians, who are Sunnis, and other Arab countries, the Egyptians, to go along with this concept, making peace with Israel is better than trying to deal with their Shia adversaries. So here we had done what Dr. Blessing likes to call realpolitik. We had isolated the very people who are the most dangerous today in the Middle East, and now we are paying the price for having gotten rid of those policies.
Well, let me ask you this. Looking back over the last 3 years, can you name one foreign policy success story for this administration?
Well, I can't. But I have to give him props. I have to give Biden props for sticking up with Israel in this latest attack. Some of our jets and the British jets shot down a lot of those incoming missiles before they reached their target. So, but he waffles. That's the thing. You can't really be certain that he will be the same one day as the next, because then he wants to pander to his voting base among the the Muslim population here in the United States, who are definitely under the influence of, and the protesters are under the influence of the Palestinians. By the way, you know the word Palestine? The Romans gave that name to what was always known as Judea. It was an insult to the Jews because Palestine is named for the Philistines, who are the biblical most persistent enemy of the Jews. And so not only did many of them lose their, kicked out during the diaspora by the Romans, but they also then had their land renamed for their most hated of enemies. So when you, if you are this idea of from the river to the sea, Palestine must be free, you are lending credence to this idea that the Jews must be eliminated and their state must be gone too. So who are the real occupiers? The Jews have been there since 1000 B.C. The Arabs just showed up in 638 A.D. And so if you got questions about who are the legitimate heirs to the place, also read Genesis chapter 17, and you will find there's no doubt it wasn't Ishmael, but Isaac, who should be the descendants of Abraham, who have the promised land. Now, that is just, I brought everything in here, politics, religion, and I don't know. I sometimes hope that if Trump is reelected, that he would go back to the kinds of policies he had in the Middle East before. But, you know, it's a world where you have to worry constantly about escalation of conflicts.
All right, we'll have to leave it at that.
Okay.
Bob, thanks.
Bill, have a good day.
Thanks for the call. You too, buddy. Bye-bye
yeah,
now.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's go to Redding. Gerson wants to talk about that EMS story at Wyomissing Borough. Gerson, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Good morning, Mr. Sanders, Mr. Sean, and to everyone. It is my genuine wish that everyone is in good, as good health as it is possible and well. Let me gather my thoughts here because I want to make sure I ask properly. Well, basically, Mr. Sanders, regarding the...
can you get closer to your phone so that we can hear you a little bit better?
Okay.
There we go.
Perfect. Regarding the article that you were mentioning, I believe it was on Facebook regarding Wyomissing. Basically, long story short, I am under the impression that residents typically pay through local taxes regarding emergency services. Now, pardon my ignorance, and that's why I'm calling. I would like some clarification either from you or any of our listeners that obviously have direct knowledge in regards to the matter regarding emergency services. Now, I thankfully haven't had the need to have to call or to for someone to have to call to have called emergency services for me. But I do know that as I get older, that those chances, of course, increase even if you try to maintain a healthy lifestyle. And therefore, I have called, of course, emergency services for others as need be in case of emergencies or injuries or the like. Now, I have called the police, of course. I have called fire trucks. I have called ambulances. Now, I never have gotten a bill for making those calls. However, if a person for themselves is needed, now, I also have heard of stories where people are in, a car accident, minor, nothing major, and they refuse services. Now, is a person charged for calling such services, particularly ambulances? Never mind a helicopter. I heard stories of those being very costly. But if a person, for example, has insurance, does insurance not cover that? Or if they don't have insurance, isn't that covered by our taxes, either for people that own homes, obviously their property taxes, or for anyone that rents? It's, I'm sure, somewhere included in the rent somewhere. Some of those taxes are probably paid or added or right into the rents, obviously. I'm sure owners aren't going to necessarily cover that out of their goodwill all the time. Some might. Again, I don't know how that works, but for the most part. But that's where my curiosity is, or my question and my ignorance. If an ambulance is called for me or for someone, are they costs of those? They're basically those they're not already paid for by residents as a whole. And I'm just curious. Obviously, it creates a little bit of a concern. When you have an emergency, you have an emergency. Whether it's the police, whether it's fire trucks, whether it's the ambulance, the least that you need is to have a bill afterwards because of something that you really didn't foresee or expected, or really at the worst of times to have. And sorry for rambling on. I'm just trying to better understand this. That's not going to prevent me from calling, you know, for myself or someone else as needed. But it's good to know because, like I said, so far I have never had a bill for these services. And as I age, I'm sure that that's going to become a concern. And some of us may have insurance. Some of us may not have insurance. It's just good.
Well, let me real quickly answer your question because I've got a hard break to go to here in just a minute.
Thank you.
In Wyomissing, the way it was before Borough Council said that they would pay for this, that anybody who called Western Berks EMS were charged for it. I can say from my own personal experience back in 2018, I'm not going to get into the details that resulted in me having to call for an ambulance, but when they took me to the hospital, and it might have been because of the medical coverage I had through my employer at the time that wasn't sufficient to pay the cost of that ambulance ride to the hospital. I don't remember what the dollar amount was, but I was charged for that, and it was high. It was steep. So I don't know about other municipalities and other ambulance services, and I'm hoping that if anyone out there is listening who is an EMT, might be able to answer that much better than I can. I don't know about Reading, Gerson, where you live.
Got it. Well, that clears up. Thank you. I appreciate you guys very much for trying and certainly for bringing up this very important subject to our attention. May everyone have a good rest of the day.
All right, Gerson, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good question you asked today.
Thank you. I look forward to Dr. Blessings this week. If he's available on Friday, I may have a question for him that I've been holding off for a while now.
All right, buddy. You take care.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Bye-bye now. We'll be back with more of Feedback on this Monday in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Myerstown, Fredericksburg, Newmanstown, and all of Lebanon County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
Welcome back to Feedback on this Monday morning. Right here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. The Voice of Berks and Beyond, for sure. Right here on your on Air Town Square, known as Feedback. Well, the first criminal case for Donald Trump is getting underway today with the start of jury selection, and it might take a while for them to come up with a jury for this case up there in New York. This I got from Reuters. They are reporting that when prospective New York City jurors gather for Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial today, it may be tough to find ones who don't have an opinion about the brash businessman-turned-politician who began building his real estate empire in Manhattan decades ago. They'll be questioned by lawyers for the Republican presidential candidate and the state of New York, seeking to uncover biases and possible political agendas before impaneling 12 jurors to hear what could be the only criminal case Trump faces before the November U.S. election. There is almost nobody in New York who doesn't have an opinion about Donald Trump, so says trial lawyer Paul Applebaum, who's not involved in the case. He went on to say in this Reuters piece, a lot of people think he's either Satan incarnate or the second coming of Jesus. But even if Trump is a polarizing figure and Manhattan is a Democratic stronghold, having an opinion will not be enough to disqualify a potential juror. Justice Juan Merchan, overseeing the case, has indicated he will not disqualify people based solely on whether they lean Republican or Democratic. Political orientation is not necessarily a cause for bias, said jury consultant Melissa Gomez of IMS Legal Strategies. But if it's so strong that the person will be motivated to convict, that's a problem, she says. The criminal case is one of four Trump faces and the first ever for a past or present U.S. president. While a conviction would not bar Trump from retaking office should he defeat Democratic President Joe Biden, a Reuters Ipsos poll last week showed it could be a critical factor for voters. Some 64% of registered voters in that five-day poll, which closed last Monday, described the charges as at least somewhat serious, compared to 34% who said the charges lack seriousness. Trump has pleaded not guilty to falsifying business records to cover up a sexual encounter that porn star Stormy Daniels says they had. Trump denies having had the encounter with Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford. Jury selection is likely to take roughly a week in a case expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. Potential jurors are randomly selected from voter rolls and other state records. So that'll be interesting to see how that turns out. And boy, do I know how opinionated New Yorkers are. I dated one for a while there. And boy, oh boy, I do know how opinionated they can be. Anyway, the juror or the judge in the Hunter Biden gun case says that she's refused to throw out the federal gun case against him. This, according to the Associated Press, the federal judge in Delaware on Friday refused to throw out a federal gun case against Hunter Biden, that is, rejecting the president's son's claim that he is being prosecuted for political purposes, as well as other arguments. U.S. District Judge Mary Ellen Noreika's ruling increases the prospect that Biden could face trial in the case as early as June, in the midst of his father's reelection campaign. His efforts to scuttle the other criminal case he faces out there in California involving tax allegations have also failed. Noreika denied several defense requests to dismiss the case, charging Biden with lying about his drug use in October of 2018. On a form to buy a gun that he kept for about 11 days. His lawyers had argued the case was politically motivated and asserted that an immunity provision from an original plea deal that fell apart still holds. They had also challenged the appointment of Delaware U.S. Attorney David Wise as special counsel to lead the prosecution. Noreika, who was appointed to the bench by former President Donald Trump, has not yet ruled on a challenge to the constitutionality of the gun charges. Hunter Biden has pleaded not guilty in that case. The president's son has acknowledged struggling with an addiction to crack cocaine during that period in 2018, but his lawyers have said he didn't break the law and another nonviolent first-time offender would not have been charged. So that's where that stands as far as Hunter Biden is concerned. And with that, we're going to take a break. And we'll be back with the final moments of hour number two of today's feedback show in just a bit. Stay with us.
Traffic.
It's a source I can trust.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Melon with a song called No Rain here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. By the way, that wraps up hour number two of feedback. Stay with us because during the third hour today, I'll be joined by a couple of folks from the Council on Chemical Abuse. as we talk about Alcohol Awareness Month, which is what April is, and the costs to families and communities that alcohol abuse has. And they'll be taking your questions, too, at 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. Right now, we're going to break for news with Radio PA and ABC, and our own Bob McCool will have a check on sports for you. So keep it here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU in Reading.
The following is a paid Feature of the Day interview. The views expressed during Feature of the Day are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of News Talk 830 WEEU.
Welcome back to Feedback as we continue with hour number three of the show this morning on this Monday morning, beautiful Monday morning out there. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders along with producer Sean Tansky. And our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text number is 484-650-3373. And today we're going to talk about alcohol abuse, because it is Alcohol Awareness Month here on April. The Council on Chemical Abuse is Berks County's single county authority. They're responsible for the planning of prevention, treatment, intervention, and recovery services. They help to coordinate those efforts so that people suffering from the disease of addiction can have the best chance to recover and sustain long-term sobriety. For centuries, alcohol has been a staple in every community, used as a celebration prop, a ceremony toast, or a problem solver. Alcohol, aka spirits, aka booze, remains the number one drug used by youth and adults in the United States. According to the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, nearly 86% of people aged 18 and older reported that they drank alcohol at some point in their lifetime. But the consequences of irresponsible consumption cost Americans over $200 billion annually, that's billion with a B, in workplace productivity loss, health care costs, criminal justice costs, and motor vehicle crashes. Each April since 1987, the National Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence, Incorporated, or NCADD for short, has sponsored Alcohol Awareness Month to increase public awareness and understanding, reduce stigma, and encourage local communities to focus on alcoholism and alcohol-related issues. The Council on Chemical Abuse plans and develops various programs and projects aimed at educating and raising awareness about the effects of alcohol. With me to talk about these activities and programs to address alcohol prevention is Zoe Stankiewicz, a prevention specialist with COCA, Leslie Houck, also a prevention specialist with COCA, and Yvonne Stroman, community program specialist. Ladies, good morning and welcome to Feedback today.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having
goodness.
Us.
Having all three voices come at me today. It's glad to have you with us today. So what and how does the Council on Chemical Abuse address educating the community on the use and misuse of substances?
So there are a number of ways, Bill. First, just let me say that overall, the Council on Chemical Abuse is SCA's single county authority, is Berks County's single county authority. And basically, our charge is to raise education, provide awareness, and let folks understand the consequences that are associated with substance use and misuse. And so when we talk about substance use, we're talking about alcohol, tobacco, illicit drugs, marijuana, though, you know, folks will contend, but, you know, there's a prescription for that. It's actually not a prescription, it's a recommendation. And so I like to educate people about the legalities around marijuana use. And despite the fact that, you know, these substances are available in our communities, there is what we call individuals misusing them to the point that it becomes consequential in their lives, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to also then have information about where individuals can go to get the help that they need so that they can enter into the realm of recovery and that they can rebuild their lives in a way that is beneficial then to themselves, their families, and the community overall.
Okay.
So with all of that, we are in the classrooms, we're in the community talking about the dangers and consequences that are associated with, in this instance, since we're talking about alcohol, because it's Alcohol Awareness Month, mm-hmm. about alcohol. You know, and you and I have had these conversations in the past,
right,
about America's relationship with alcohol. I consider it to be an affair because we've been, alcohol has been in our lives for centuries, right? Mm-hmm. Used as, you know, back in colonial days, they used alcohol to trade fur, to trade animals, that type of thing. And mm-hmm. so even during the prohibition times, whereby alcohol was identified as illegal, people still found ways through their own home remedies of making it a part of their lives. And through, you know, distilleries and, you know, the word spirits come from, you know, people being inebriated and thinking that they were seeing things that weren't there. So, right. So here we are with spirits. And so we just got to really talk about how we view the substance and what can be the outcome and consequences of it when individuals use it to the point that it's beyond, you know, it's out of control, if you will.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So why is alcohol so prevalent in our communities across the country?
Well, I'm going to let Zoe and Leslie talk about that. But, you know, I also just kind of say it's been with us for so long. And, you know, we also have to look at how society has accepted it. States are legalizing it for those that are over the age of 21. But then you have in some homes where parents and love and caregivers are making a decision to say, I'm going to allow my youth to have a sip of beer, or even during ceremonial times, you know, at mm-hmm. wedding receptions or at holiday parties or birthday parties, they're giving, you know, loved ones, a sip to try it and see if they like it. And therein, you know, depending upon the brain can, you know, strike a different kind of nuance to it that young people say, well, you know what, this feels good and tastes good, and I want to continue to feel good and taste good, right? I think I was here last month and just said, we as human beings, we don't like to feel uncomfortable. We don't like those icky feelings, and we're going to look for those nuances that allow us to feel good. And sometimes it happens to be alcohol, and it's a celebrant. People use it as part of their traditions. People use it, you know, they toast to the new year. They, you know, we find different ways and pathways and means by which to get alcohol and use it. And unless, you know, we are given the information about the history of alcohol and even in our families of how it can be a disruption in our family lives, we just kind of take it as a second nature to, I'm just looking at the water in our newsroom here, second nature to water, and people don't really think twice about it. And that's why the education is so important.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It seems like so, and we'll get to that in just a minute, but it seems like it is so influential in our lives that even during Prohibition, people found a way to get to alcohol and consume it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also it's a social thing as well. I mean, it's has people, you know, it gets people to come together for different things as well. So I think there's a social aspect along it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, a lot of people can see it as a coping mechanism for different things as well. And that's something that we really like to stress in the classrooms when we're doing these prevention programs, is it's not a coping mechanism. And, you know, especially with, you know, kids and teens, we stress that, you know, that your brain isn't developed until you're 25. So adding any type of substances in there, it can, you know, stop its growth and, you know, make it harder for you. So we really like to stress that factor as well.
Okay.
I think that's so important too. And to Yvonne's point as well, we were kind of, Zoe and I were even discussing just the accessibility, you know, that our youth have, and the example that we're setting for our young people as well, that it's always a good time to reexamine our relationship with alcohol, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it may mean completely abstaining because it is an issue. And for others, maybe it's just taking a break or, you know, kind of examining our motives behind choosing to drink, as well as, you know, talking to adults and parents about the accessibility mm-hmm. that they provide to young people, to teens and to kids, you know, the kind of example that they're going to be setting, and, you know, understanding the legality around hosting parties that there's going to be alcohol. if you're an adult, that you can be held legally responsible for that. And, mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a fallacy that has been out there that, you know, if you host a party and, well, if my kids are here with me, it's better if they drink here at home. Mm-hmm. But the evidence just doesn't show that that works, unfortunately. So that's a big part of our prevention as well. And we have tools on our website and things like that about how can you talk with your kids about alcohol. You know, you can do it as simple as you're riding in the car to carpool somewhere. It's an ongoing conversation to continue having with our kids and our young people. And Zoe and I were also just talking on the way here about how cool it is that we're seeing upcoming generations already kind of examining their relationships with alcohol. We have, you know, millennials and young people choosing not to drink or drink less for a variety of reasons. So that's also really hopeful. We have a great generation that's coming up and, you know, kind of seeing maybe what some of the people before them chose to do and kind of maybe deciding to go a little bit of a different way. And I know Zoe's going to talk about our YLC coalition, which is coming up, which is so awesome as well. So, you know, we are seeing that there's some hope with that, that, you know, if we equip our young people with some of the facts and the opportunity to make other decisions, mm-hmm. that, you know, we believe that there's going to be a lot of them that will choose to go down that road instead and maybe, you know, have a better future in terms of their family and things like that, of the legacy that they want to leave for the next generations in terms of their relationships with alcohol and other substances. So,
speaking of young people, are there specific programs that address underage drinking in schools today?
So our prevention programs, we have two big evidence-based programs that we do in schools, mm-hmm. that do address, addresses a variety of substances, but alcohol is definitely one of them that we talk about. And
okay.
we start these programs kindergarten, first grade, and kids do know that.
Kindergarten and first grade you start out
absolutely.
With?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So.
Really?
Yeah. So the prevention programs can start as young as then.
You're not saying that there are kids in kindergarten and first grade who have had alcohol, are you?
I wouldn't say that. I would just say, you know, they're around it with their parents or guardians or anyone at home that, you know, might be drinking or they're curious, you know. So we want to make sure that we can address the fact that it is dangerous, especially for someone under the age of 21.
Okay.
And things like that. So both of those programs address alcohol, the dangers of alcohol, and, you know, what could happen if, you know, over drinking and things like that. So, yeah.
All right, and Zoe, while I'm talking with you, you help create and organize a program called Youth Coalition that we were talking about off the air.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so our Youth Leadership Council, it consists of kids from all Berks County schools, 9th through 12th grade.
Okay.
And we just started it this year. So they're working on prevention projects that they can bring back to their schools. We've worked on a lot of community service projects. We just had a big event last Monday with another youth group in the area, Voice Up Berks. They're youth mental health ambassadors. So they had a program all about coping skills and healthy coping skills. And our Youth Leadership Council did a presentation on vaping and in relation to coping skills. So there's this common misconception that a lot of people think that if they're vaping, that's a good stress management tool. And obviously that, you know, evidence shows that it has the opposite effect. You know, it's actually a stimulant. So they did a wonderful presentation with talking about that. So that was one of the events that we just had coming up. Over the holidays, we had a clothing drive that the youth put together. And a lot of people came from, you know, different some people just saw it off the street and they were curious what it was.
Oh,
so
cool.
They came on in and it was a really good event. And then in a few weeks, we'll be going to the Capitol building. So we have a nice group of kids.
In Harrisburg?
Yeah. So we'll
oh,
be going
nice.
For tobacco advocacy. It's a day at the Capitol. It's May 7th. So
oh, that's wonderful.
They're looking forward to that.
Now, Youth Coalition, is this held in conjunction with a school district or is it held separately?
It's held separately. So any kid from any Berks County school, grades 9 through 12, can join. You can check it out on our website. We have meetings.
Which is what? Give the website the address.
www.cocaberks.org.
Okay.
And we have Zoom meetings, so you don't even have to leave your house to get to the meetings as well. We have some in-person meetings as well. We're looking forward to next year because now that we've had our first year, you know, kind of figuring out how things work out, I feel like we really have it nailed down for this next year. So I'm very excited what can come up for next year.
Oh, that's cool. And again, these are for young people in what age group?
9th through 12th grade. Any Berks County student, high school student.
Okay. And give me some of the benefits of the coalition.
Yeah, so some of the benefits are they obviously get to collaborate with other kids from different schools. And as well as we do have a scholarship that we offer through COCA. So they have, you know, a good chance, you know, probably to get that scholarship
since
they've worked so hard with us. So that's definitely a benefit, as well as community service hours. So a lot of our youth are super into community service. And so I know one is working towards the highest amount of community service hours in his school. So he was very excited for this opportunity.
So this does serve as a community service for somebody who has to do some community service to get credit in their schools. Mm-hmm. This applies to
that, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know a lot of schools have a certain amount of community service hours, or some kids are just very interested in doing it on their own,
right?
Mm-hmm. Which is great. So yes, this will apply to that as well.
And how long does this go? I mean, is this a year-round program or what?
Yeah, so since it started in the beginning of the school year, September, I'm thinking like a school year, so September to May-ish, June, because, you know, kids have their own things going on during the summer and then starting it back up again in September. We start off with a kickoff event, so...
Are there any upcoming events or activities that the Youth Coalition is hosting that you can tell us about?
Just our day at the Capitol event that they're going to is kind of our wrap up for the year. So they'll be going there with many other schools all throughout Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
I know Reading High is bringing a group, which is great, but it's all about tobacco advocacy for the day.
Okay.
So talking to their local legislators and legislators in Pennsylvania, and we have a really nice day planned for them. So
nice.
We're looking forward to that.
That's nice. Share with me, what do you say to a child who says, "What's wrong with alcohol? My parents drank it."
Yeah.
What's the answer?
I think the most important is we focus on youth. So yes, maybe your parents are drinking it, but it's important for you as you're under the age of 21 and your brains are still growing. And there's so much that, you know, have coming up that, you know, it's harmful for you. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the same prevention techniques that we use with some of our other substances in classrooms and events and things like that. You know, we talk about their goals, like, raise your hand. What do you want to do with yourself? You know, maybe they want to start a business. So a lot of times we'll point back to that. You know, will this get to your goals? Mm-hmm. You know, we have a lot of athletes, you know, that we speak to. How is this going to affect your athletic performance? You know, if it's obviously it's a legal issue, you know, what happened if you got busted for underage drinking or drunk driving or something like that?
Absolutely.
Does that, you know, point towards the goals that you want to go towards or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, will it help you to reach those things? You know, as well as your brain development, you know, is very important, and just trying to emphasize that. And we get some really good feedback from the kids about it. And, you know, our kids are exposed to a lot. Like, you know, they've seen people who have had too much to drink, you know.
So true.
And so we talk about that. And I think, you know, especially if we get the chance to talk with parents too, just emphasizing keeping those lines of communication open, continuing to having those conversations and answering their questions. You know, kids ask great questions if you give them the opportunity, you know, just answer the question that they're directly asking. I think it can feel very overwhelming and daunting maybe for caregivers and grownups of how to answer some of those questions. But if you get some tools, which we provide all on our website and through this entire month as well on our Instagram page and things like that, there's so many great resources to help walk them through some of that, to just continue to have those conversations, you know, well, what looked fun about that? Or what did you think when you saw that person, you know? Did it look like it's healthy for them? Or, you know, they have a relative or somebody who's maybe had their lives affected negatively through alcohol, having those conversations. Our kids are smart. They're perceptive, you know.
Yeah.
So having age-appropriate conversations around substances and alcohol is, like I said, it's just having those lines of communications open. And we have great tools to help parents do that in a way that really makes sense for them for all those great questions.
Now that you brought up parents, are parents brought in on the Youth Coalition program at all, or no? Is it just with young people that you're dealing with?
It's youth ran. So I like, it's kind of nice that they can openly talk about what they feel like is affecting them in their school.
Okay.
Obviously, parents are informed and things like that, exactly of what they're doing and everything like that. You know, obviously.
So you communicate with the parents of the kids that are participating in this?
Okay. Absolutely. Yep. Definitely that open line of communication. But, you know, our youth are the ones that are being affected the most, and they know what's affecting their peers the most and things like that. So all of the projects that they are interested in and they want to do are the things that they feel as if are affecting their peers the most as well. So I think that the future of the Youth Leadership Council would be more youth driven and youth led, which is what we kind of want to do, because there's so many great programs that are already out there that are youth led. And I think that, I mean, like I said, they know what's going on, and it's important to have them be that voice of prevention as well.
Do you find it more effective when a young person hears from another young person as opposed to an adult telling them things?
Yeah, I know that when we talk to the youth about what they feel is the most, you know, the best, you know, way for prevention, they definitely say coming from peer mentors are the best, because, you know, we can come in and to a classroom and do our presentations and things like that. But I think really hearing from youth is important. And that's why I really love this event that we had this past Monday, because it was all youth led and all of the youth were speaking. And it was this very, you know, safe space of group talking about different, you know, mental health issues as well as substance abuse issues. And it was really interesting to hear, you know, the youth's take on different things, especially coping mechanisms and things like that.
We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, I want to talk with you further about some of the things in detail that the young people shared with you in this youth coalition. But before we take our break, who wants to share contact information with COCA?
Sure. So the Council on Chemical Abuse, our main line number is 610-376-8669. Or you can visit our website at COCABERKS, COCABERKS.org.
And my guests this morning are Yvonne Stroman, Leslie Houck, and Zoe Stankiewicz. They're all with the Council on Chemical Abuse of Berks County. They'll be back in just a bit as we continue our discussion on alcohol abuse in just a minute. Our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459 if you have a question for my guests when feedback continues in just a bit.
Serving Barnesville, Schuylkill Haven, Tremont, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and beyond.
Welcome back to feedback. My guests this morning are Yvonne Stroman, Zoe Stankiewicz, and Leslie Houck, all with the Council on Chemical Abuse. And since this is Alcohol Awareness Month, we're talking about alcohol abuse. And we're taking your questions here at 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And we've got Joe in Muhlenberg who's on the line who has a question for you. Joe, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes, many years ago when I was in Europe, most of the countries there, they don't have a like a drinking age or, and you know, that you can start drinking, and people grow up with alcohol. Of course, there's still be alcoholics and you know, and things like that. But they grew up respecting alcohol, you know, and of course, some of the big cities out there, they won't serve children or teenagers. You know, when they come in and they know they're underage. But here in America, when we have set an age, you know, as to when you can start drinking, I think that's part of the problem. I think if we didn't have like a drinking age and people grow up and learn to respect alcohol, you know, then they won't abuse it as much, especially with kids going to college. You know, you have kids that they mark their birthdays on a calendar when they turn 21, and then as soon as they turn 21, it's like they have to go out and you know, drink till you know, you even have cases of drink.
All right, Joe. Let's get the guests' take on the question about legalizing or have a legalized age for alcohol drinking. Who wants to address that?
Yeah. So, Joe, I really appreciate the comment and the information that you're sharing. And I guess when you were talking, there were like several things I wanted to mention. The first thing I'll mention is United States, when you compare the age of the United States to other countries, it's really young. United States is really relatively a young country as it relates to just our formation and policies. How are we working together or not, right? And mm-hmm. So we have other countries that are a little bit older and have more established in terms of how they view alcohol. I think it's we got to take a look at the normalcy that United States gives alcohol and the use of alcohol. And so when you talk about releasing the age limit, you got to remember there was a period of time that in the United States, the legal age was 18, right? And mm-hmm. what they saw was through data, the number of car crashes and fatalities related to alcohol was among our teens, which is why they increased it to the age of 21. And we got to thank Mothers Against Drunk Drivers for looking at this, saying we've got to do better. And then they increased the age to 21. But what you're having even still, to your point, the idea that alcohol is used in our social settings has just been so normalized that we have parents who are providing the substance to their children who are under the age of 21. We have, you know, teens in college that sees this as a rite of passage. And so we have to look at what are our attitudes and beliefs about alcohol before we can think about how do we manage it in terms of reducing or releasing the age, because we're still seeing outcomes, negative outcomes. And Bill, you mentioned it earlier, where there's billions of dollars that are being cost to taxpayers because of car crash fatalities. And oh, by the way, if you don't have insurance and you know, you're under the influence and you crash somebody's vehicle or home, you know, who's responsible for that? If there is young people who are suffering from alcohol poisoning, and we haven't talked about binge drinking, but that happens, and they're going to the emergency room and they don't have insurance, who bears that cost? And so I would dare say we have to take a look at how are other countries dealing with it, and then what are they willing to assume in the way of a role of responsibility for the consequences that are associated with it. That much we don't, I don't hear that piece. I hear about countries saying, mm-hmm. you know, there's a different take on it than the United States, but what are some of the outcomes from that?
Do we know if any of the other countries have data available? And if so, are you aware of what the data is that shows that there's abuse among young people on with alcohol?
That's the question that I don't have an answer to, Bill, but I'd be interested to know. I know, you know, I had a colleague go to Amsterdam maybe last year, and it was just in a spirit of learning about how Amsterdam is dealing with their policies around even marijuana use, because in some places it's just open air use of substances. Mm-hmm. But what's happening? What is the fallout from that? I don't hear and see about that, mm-hmm. Which I'd be interested to know.
Okay. Joe, thank you for your call. Appreciated the question today. 610-374-8800 or toll free 888-401-0459. Time is getting away from me. I'm going to have to take another commercial break here. But before we do, Yvonne, what's the contact information for Coca Burks?
The Council on Chemical Abuse, our number is 610-376-8669. And our website, cocaburks.org.
And we'll be back with more feedback in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Tamaqua, Pottsville, Pine Grove, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU. The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback, where our numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. I have with me in studio today Zoe Stankiewicz, Leslie Houck, and Yvonne Stroman, all with the Council on Chemical Abuse. And we're talking about In this particular instance, since this month is Alcohol Awareness Month, we're talking about the issues of alcoholism and addiction to alcoholism. And one of the things that we were talking about earlier, Zoe, was the youth coalition that you put together. Share with us some of the topics that were addressed at the most recent one. What were the topics that were most important on the minds of young people, and what was the response?
Yeah, so I think that our most important thing is teens are very hyper aware of, you know, their mental health.
Okay.
And just making sure that they have the tools and skills around them to keep themselves, you know, in a positive mindset.
Now let me stop you there for a minute. When you say that they are aware of mental health, are they concerned that they might be experiencing mental health problems, or are they just concerned about the issue in general?
I think it could be a little bit of both as well, you know, making sure that they're keeping their stress, you know, low, making sure they're having those stress management skills and things like that. So our event was all about coping skills. So how you cope with, you know, having a rough day. What are some things that you can do that are positive coping skills for yourself? So a lot of the kids, you know, they say, you know, listen to music, go on a walk, things like that. So our part in the day, like I said, was all about vaping, because there's this, you know, notion, and the kids are very hyper aware of vaping as well, because it's a big issue in schools. You know, I was just at a school this past week. They said a third grader brought in a vape. They were unsure what it was, but
they weren't using it though.
No,
were they?
They were unsure what it was. Had it in their backpacks, you know, saw it at home, and thought that they, you know, should bring it to school. So, vaping is definitely a huge issue with kids, teens. So, our youth leadership council is very much interested in trying to figure out how to, you know, bring awareness to the fact that, yes, it's not a coping skill. It's not a healthy coping skill to your stress management that you're struggling with. It's actually doing the opposite. It's a stimulant. So that was our part in that day. But, you know, kids and teens are very much into keeping their mental health, you know, positive mindset and things like that, which I think is great, because, you know, as someone that has a psychology background, I love that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I love the fact that kids are, you know, being hyper aware of this topic as well, because it's so important.
So the Youth Coalition is more than just about alcohol.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's about all addictions.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. So it's, you know, about whatever the kids bring to us that they feel as if there is, you know, the biggest issue that they see in their school at the moment.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
And I understand there was another event that was held last Thursday regarding Alcohol Awareness Month. Leslie, what was that all about?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. So on Thursday, April 11th, we hosted our Dancing with Purpose event, which was really great. Albright was so wonderful to allow us to host it there with our partners at Diamond Credit Union. So we got together some instructors. We had free salsa dancing.
Oh, cool.
With Wander Holdren, who was wonderful. We did Zumba. We had a keynote speaker who talked about issues in our community surrounding alcohol and drinking. The whole event was free. We had delicious food. You know, just an opportunity for the community to come together and celebrate in a way that shows, you know, our community that you don't necessarily need alcohol to make an event fun. And everyone who came and participated had so much fun. And it was just a really great time. We had a DJ there. And, you know, it was just a great opportunity to just come together and have some wholesome fun.
Now, is this for people of all age groups or just teenagers?
Yep. We opened it up to the entire community, youth, families. We did have a couple of families there. We had the Zion dance team from Albright was there. So there was students. So it was a really great multi-generational opportunity to just kind of come together and celebrate. So it was a lot of fun. So we do annually an event for alcohol awareness. And it's usually something with a purpose. This year was dancing with a purpose. Last year's activity was painting with a purpose.
Okay.
So we're looking forward to seeing what we can come together and do for next year. You know, just to be able to be together and, you know, celebrate and enjoy and have great activities that, you know, don't necessarily require alcohol.
So, I like that. That's a nice idea. Are there other agencies or collaborators besides Coca Berks that are supporting Alcohol Awareness Month or doing anything for Alcohol Awareness Month this month?
So we usually work in collaboration with other organizations and agencies. The one thing I need to say, Bill, is that if individuals, if there's somebody listening or a loved one that's listening that has a family member, loved one that's struggling, with alcohol that there is help available, and they should reach out to us at the Council on Chemical Abuse, and we can guide them to the next step in terms of how to get an appropriate evaluation and then how to get those services that they need. And so along with that then is the opportunity to collaborate with our service contractors, as well as even other organizations and agencies. Leslie mentioned the last year was Painting with a Purpose. And so this, in collaboration with the SOS Berks, they were able to bring community members together to paint a mural. And we were on the show last month, last fall, I believe, talking about that mural and how the mural really is an opportunity to illustrate that hope helps, that hope is available, that help is available, and that people can and do recover from the disease of addiction, right? And so at that time, it was based on Jose L's world, growing up in a family, and he having a substance use disorder really relies on family, the strength of family, the help of family to get well, and you know, on his journey of recovery. And then this Thursday will be a mural. We'll do another mural dedication, and this is called The Journey, and it actually is the based on my life as a person in long-term recovery. Yes, and so we will have a dedication of that mural on Thursday at 3 o'clock. Many know when I share my story that alcohol was my drug of choice, and I'm in recovery from alcohol use disorder. And so we decided to do that that dedication during April for Alcohol Awareness Month, to show that help, hope, and healing does evolve when individuals extend the hand of help, of hope, and individuals receive help, that the life of recovery and the journey of recovery does begin and continues. I like to tell people they're not recovered, or I'm not recovered, that this is a lifelong journey. This is a lifelong illness, and one day at a time, through my own journey of exposure to family, friends, colleagues, and just my connection with a higher power, that 33 years of long-term recovery and have not had the need to have a drink of alcohol, life is good. Life is very good,
Bill. That's wonderful.
And we just like to extend that to individuals that feel like, you know, they need help, that help is available.
And where is that mural located?
The mural is located on 11th Street, North 11th Street, over by Albright. And so we got to give a shout out to Albright for being that lifelong partner and collaborator with us, whether it's to extend invitation and information about alcohol and underage drinking, or to lend their support for individuals who are getting well. It's on North 11th Street, right behind Wawa. And so Albright, it's their it's one of their buildings. I think it's like a mechanical room, but there's that's where the mural is posted.
And if I remember correctly, when we first talked about this mural program, there was an art department or an art teacher that was volunteering time with this?
Yes, and so shout out to Mike Miller.
He has been the
really the strong nexus to kind of keeping this moving forward. We brought Mike in on this idea, and he was very helpful in helping us find the locations of the site to have these murals. He has been very helpful about gathering people together for quote-unquote paint parties, is where we bring people together to work on these mural projects. And so I need to tell you that Berks County is really supportive of the work that we do when we're wanting to share help and hope. The hundreds of people have touched these murals, and we couldn't do it without the support of Berks Countyans, and so we say thank you.
And this mural is at the Albright College Total Experience Learning Building at 1041 Richland Street.
Yes.
Or Rockland Street, I beg your pardon, if I can read right. So that's at 11th and Rockland Streets there, and that's going to be this coming Thursday at 3 o'clock, am I right?
Yes.
Okay. And since we're just about out of time, any final thoughts? today from anyone?
I have to say, if you haven't seen the mural, I've driven past it, and it really is a light into our community. Being able to see Yvonne and as well as our other mural, it's really great. And I just wanted to add, right before we wrap up, too, we also do have a family recovery group through the Rise Center online on Facebook, because you know, addiction is a family disease, and there's opportunity to recover alongside of your loved one, hopefully, and it's great. And we'll have more information on that as well on our website on CocaBurks.org.
And you say there's a Facebook page about that?
They do it online, so it's a Facebook page, yes.
Okay. Whose Facebook page?
It's Becky Van Etten. She is a certified family recovery specialist, and she hosts a Facebook Live for families who are dealing with loved ones that are struggling with the disease of addiction. She, as a mom who's worked with or gotten help for her family members, she's now extending that hope, help, and healing.
I want to thank Yvonne Stroman, Zoe Stankiewicz, and Leslie Houck, all with the Council on Chemical Abuse of Berks County, for being my guests this morning. Ladies, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it. We'll be back with the final moments of feedback today in just a bit. Stay with us.
News, talk, and weather.
It's the topics that matter to me.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
Well, that'll do it for another edition of Feedback. We'll be back tomorrow when my guest will be Craig Snyder, who is political director of Pennsylvania's Forward Party. We'll talk about what the Forward Party is all about and who the candidates are that they will be fielding in this November election. So stay with us for that tomorrow. Thank you, everyone who called in or wrote in with their opinions of the issues of the day. You folks are the stars of the show, and we'll do it again tomorrow. And I want to thank my producer, Sean Tansky. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate all you do. Whoops, did I hear you?
No problem. Maybe I have it on.
There we go.
Not a problem.
All right, we're going to break for news with Radio PA and ABC, and then it's sports time with our own Bob McCool before we have a whole afternoon of talk radio with Dan Bongino and the Ramsey Show this afternoon. Until tomorrow, make it a great rest of your day today. That'll do it for this episode of Feedback. To comment on the show, you can email us at feedback@830weeu.com. You can also hear our show live from 9 a.m. to noon Eastern Time at 830weeu.com or on the TuneIn app. For producer Sean Tansky, I'm Bill Saunders. Thanks for listening.